watching the interest of men who sat at other tables, or simply paused on the street outside. Deals for drugs and other contraband were openly transacted at the tables, but the goods could only be exchanged outside the bar. It was common enough to see buyer and seller reach agreement on price, walk outside to hand over money and goods, then walk back inside to resume their places at a table. Even the bureaucrats and influence peddlers were bound by those unwritten rules. Agreements reached in the dark booths of the upstairs bar could only be sealed, with handshakes and cash, on the pavement outside, so that no man could say he'd paid or received bribes within the walls of Leopold. While the fine lines that divided and connected the legal and illegal were nowhere more elegantly drawn, they weren't unique to the diverse society of Leopold. The traders in the street stalls outside sold counterfeits of Lacoste, Cardin, and Cartier with a certain impudent panache. The taxi drivers parked along the street accepted tips to tilt their mirrors away from the unlawful or forbidden acts that took place on the seats behind them. And a number of the cops who attended to their duties with diligence at the station across the road had paid hefty bribes for the privilege of that lucrative posting in the city centre. Sitting at Leopold's night after night and listening to the conversations at the tables around me, I heard many foreigners and not a few Indians complain about the corruption that adhered to every aspect of public and commercial life in Bombay. My few weeks in the city had already shown me that those complaints were often fair and often true. But there's no nation uncorrupted. There's no system that's immune to the misuse of money. Privileged and powerful elites grease the wheels of their progress with kickbacks and campaign contributions in the noblest assemblies. And the rich, all over the world, live longer and healthier lives than the poor.
"There is a difference between the dishonest bribe and the honest bribe," Didier Levy once said to me. "The dishonest bribe is the same in every country, but the honest bribe is India's alone."
I smiled when he said that, because I knew what he meant. India was open. India was honest. And I liked that from the first day. My instinct wasn't to criticize. My instinct in the city I was learning to love was to observe and become involved and enjoy. I couldn't know then that in the months and years to come, my freedom and even my life would depend on the Indian willingness to tilt the mirror.
"What? Alone?" Didier gasped, returning to the table. "C'est trop. Don't you know, my dear friend, it is faintly disgusting to be alone here. And I must tell you that being disgusting is a privilege I reserve exclusively for myself. Come, we will drink."
He flopped into a chair beside me, calling his waiter to order more drinks. I'd spoken to him at Leopold's almost every night for weeks, but we'd never been alone. It surprised me that he decided to join me before Ulla, Carla, or another of his friends returned. In a small way, it was a kind of acceptance, and I felt grateful for it. He drummed his fingers on the table until the whiskey arrived, drank half his glass in a greedy gulp, and then relaxed at last, turning to me with a narrow-eyed smile.
"You are heavy in thought."
I was thinking about Leopold, looking around and taking it all in.
"Oh, a terrible place,"
he sighed, shaking his head of thick curls.
"I hate myself for enjoying it so much here."
Two men, wearing loose trousers gathered tightly at the ankles and dark green vests over their long-sleeved, thigh-length shirts, approached us and drew Didier's keen attention. They nodded to him, provoking a broad smile and a wave, and then joined a group of friends at a table not far from our own.
"Dangerous men," Didier muttered,
the smile still creasing his face as he stared at their backs.
"Afghans. Rafik, the small one, he used to run the black market in books."
"Books?"
"Passports. He was the boss. A very big fellow previously. Now he runs brown sugar through Pakistan. He makes a lot more money from the brown sugar, but he is very bitter about this losing of the book business. Men were killed in that struggle. Most of them his men."
It wasn't possible that they could have heard the remark, but just then the two Afghans turned in their seats and stared at us with dark, serious expressions, as if responding to his words. One of their companions at the table leaned close and spoke to them. He pointed at Didier, then at me, and they shifted their gaze to look directly into my eyes.
"Killed," Didier repeated softly,
smiling even more broadly, until the two men turned their backs to us once more.
"I would refuse to do business with them. If only they did not do such a good business."
He was speaking out of the corner of his mouth like a prisoner under the eyes of the warders. It struck me as funny. In Australian prisons, that whispering technique is known as side-valving. The expression spoke itself clearly in my mind, and together with Didier's mannerism, the words put me back in a prison cell. I could smell the cheap disinfectant, hear the metal hiss of the keys, and feel the sweating stone under my fingertips. Flashbacks are common to ex-prisoners, cops, soldiers, ambulance drivers, firefighters, and others who see and experience trauma. Sometimes the flashback is so sudden and so inappropriate to the surrounding circumstance that the only sane reaction is foolish, uncontrollable laughter.
"Oh, you think I'm joking?" Didier puffed indignantly.
"No, no, not at all."
"This is the truth, I assure you. There was a small war over this business. See, here, even now as we speak, the victors arrive. That is Bayram and his men. He is Iranian. He is an enforcer and one of those who works for Abdul Ghani, who in his turn works for one of the great crime lords of the city, Abdelkader Khan. They won this little war, and now it is they who control the business in passport books."
He gestured with a slight nod of his head to point out a group of young men, dressed in stylish Western jeans and jackets, who'd just entered through one of the arches. They walked to the manager's desk and greeted the owners of Leopold's warmly before taking a table on the far side of the room. The leader of their group was a tall, heavy-set man in his early 30s. He lifted his plump, jovial face above the heads of his friends and swept the room from right to left, acknowledging deferential nods and friendly smiles from a number of acquaintances at other tables. As his eyes found us, Didier waved a greeting.
"Blood," he said softly through his bright smile. "For a time yet, these passports will be stamped in blood. For me, it is nothing. In matters of food, I am French. In matters of love, I am Italian. And in matters of business, I am Swiss. Very Swiss. Strictly neutral. But there will be more blood on these books. Of that I am sure."
He turned to me and blinked once, twice, as if severing the thread of daydream with his thick lashes.
"I must be drunk," he said with pleasurable surprise. "Let's have another drink."
"You go ahead. I'll sit on this one. How much do these passports cost?"
"Anything from 100 to 1,000. Dollars, of course. Do you want to buy one?"
"No."
"Ah, this is a Bombay gold dealer's no. It is a no that means maybe. And the more passionate the no, the more definite the maybe. When you want one, come to me. I will arrange it for you. For a small commission, of course."
"You make a lot of commissions here?"
"It goes. I cannot complain,"
he grinned, his blue eyes gleaming through lenses of pink alcoholic wetness.
"I make ends meet, as they say, and when they meet, I get a payment from both of the ends. Just now, tonight, I made the arrangements for a sale. 2 kilos of Manali hashish. You see those Italian tourists over there, by the fruits? The fellow with the long blonde hair and the girl in red? They wanted to buy. Someone, you see him, out there on the street, the one with a dirty shirt and no shoes, waiting for his commission. He put them to me, and then I, in my turn, put them to Ajoy. He makes hashish business, and he is an excellent criminal. See now, he sits with them, and all are smiling. The deal is done. My work for this night is finished. I am a free man!
He thumped the table for another drink. But when the small bottle arrived, he grasped it for a while with both hands, staring at it with a brooding, pensive expression.
How long will you stay in Bombay?
He asked, without looking at me.
I don't know. It's funny, everyone seems to ask me that in the last few days. You have already stayed longer than the usual. Most people cannot depart the city too quickly.
There's a guide. Prabhakar's his name. Do you know him?
Prabhakar Kare. The big smile.
That's him. He's been showing me around for weeks now. I've seen all the temples and museums and art galleries and a lot of the bazaars. From tomorrow morning, he's promised to show me something of the other side of the city. The really city, he called it. He made it sound interesting. I'll stick around for that and make my mind up then where I want to go next. I'm in no hurry.
It's a very sad thing to be in no hurry, and I would not be so free in admitting it if I were you,
he said, still staring at the bottle. When he wasn't smiling, his face looked flabby, slack, and pallid grey. He was unwell, but it was the kind of unwell you have to work at.
We have a saying in Marseille, a man in no hurry gets nowhere fast. I have been in no hurry for 8 years.
Suddenly his mood changed. He poured a splash from the bottle, looked at me with a smile, and raised his glass.
So, let's drink. To Bombay, a fine place to be in no hurry, and to civilized policemen who will accept a bribe in the interests of the order, if not of the law. To bakshish.
I'll drink to that, I said, clattering my glass against his in the toast. So, tell me, Didier, what keeps you here in Bombay?
I am French, he replied, admiring the dew on his half-raised glass. I am gay, I am Jewish, and I am a criminal. More or less in that order. Bombay is the only city I have ever found that allows me to be all four of those things at the same time.
We laughed and drank, and he turned his gaze on the wide room, his hungry eyes finally coming to rest on a group of Indian men who sat near one of the entrances. He studied them for a while, sipping slowly at his drink.
Well, if you decide to stay, you have picked a good time for it. This is a time of changes, great changes. You see those men eating foods with such strong appetite? They are Sainiks, workers for the Shiv Sena. Hatchet men, I think, is the charming English political phrase. Your guide, has he told you of the Sena?
No, I don't think so.
A conscious lapse, I would say. The Shiv Sena party is the face of the future in Bombay. Perhaps their mode and their politique is the future everywhere.
What kind of politics?
Oh, regional, language-based, ethnic, us against them, he replied,
sneering cynically as he ticked each characteristic off on the fingers of his left hand. They were very white, soft hands. His long fingernails were black with dirt under the edges.
The politics of fear. I hate politics, and politicians even more. They make a religion of being greedy. It's unforgivable. A man's relationship to his greed is a deeply personal thing, don't you think? The Shiv Sena controls the police, because they are a Maharashtrian party, and most of the lower ranks of the police are Maharashtrians. They control a lot of the slums, too, and many of the unions, and some of the press. They have everything, in fact, except the money. Oh, they have the support of the sugar barons and some of the merchants, but the real money, the industrial money and the black money, that is in the hands of the Parsis and the Hindus from other cities in India, and, most hated of all, the Muslims. And here is the struggle. The guerre économique, the truth behind their talk of race and language and region. They are changing the city, a little less and a little more every day. Even the name has been changed, from Bombay to Mumbai. They haven't managed to change the maps yet, but they will do it. And they will do almost anything, join with almost anyone in their quest. There are opportunities, fortunes. Just in the last few months, some cynics, oh, not the public ones, not the highly placed ones, made a deal with Rafik and his Afghans and the police. In exchange for certain cash and concessions, the police closed down all but a few of the opium dens in the city. Dozens of the finest smoking parlors, places that have served the community for generations, were closed in a single week, closed forever. Normally, I do not interest myself in the pigsty of politics, or in the slaughterhouse of big business for that matter. The only force more ruthless and cynical than the business of big politics is the politics of big business. But this is big politics and big business together, in the destruction of the opium smoking, and I am incensed. I ask you, what is Bombay without its chandu, its opium, and its opium dens? What is the world coming to? It's a disgrace.
I watched the men he'd described, as they concentrated with energetic single-mindedness on their meal. The table was heaped with platters of rice, chicken, and vegetable dishes. None of the five men spoke, nor did they so much as look at one another as they ate, bending low to their plates and scooping the food into their mouths rapidly.
"That's a pretty good line," I commented, grinning widely. "The one about the business of big politics and the politics of big business. I like it." "Oh, my dear friend, I cannot claim it as my own. It was Kaula who said it to me the first time, and I have used it ever since. I am guilty of many crimes, of most crimes, to say the truth, but I have never claimed a cleverness that was not my own."
"Admirable," I laughed.
"Well," he puffed, "a man has to draw the line somewhere. Civilization, after all, is defined by what we forbid more than what we permit."
He paused, drumming the fingers of his right hand on the cold marble tabletop. After a few moments, he glanced around at me.
"That is one of mine," he said,
apparently peeved that I hadn't drawn attention to the phrase. When I didn't react, he spoke again.
"About the civilization, it was one of mine."
"And damn clever," I responded quickly.
"Oh, nothing at all," he said modestly.
Then he caught my eye, and we both laughed out loud. "What was in it for Rafik, if you don't mind my asking? That stuff about closing all the opium dens. Why did he go along with it?"
"Go along with it?" Didier frowned. "Why, it was his idea. There is more money to be made from Garad, brown sugar heroin, than there is from opium. And now everyone, all the poor who were chandu smokers, they have become Garad smokers. Rafik controls the Garad, the brown sugar. Not all of it, of course. No one man controls all the thousands of kilos of brown sugar that come from Afghanistan, through Pakistan, into India. But a lot of it is his, a lot of the Bombay brown heroin. This is big money, my friend. Big money."
"Why did the politicians go along with it?"
"Ah, it is not only brown sugar and hashish that comes from Afghanistan into India,"
he confided, lowering his voice and speaking from the corner of his mouth once more.
"There are guns, heavy weapons, explosives. The Sikhs are using these weapons now in Punjab, and the Muslim separatists in Kashmir. There are weapons, you see? And there is power, the power to speak for many of the poor Muslims who are the enemies of the Shiv Sena. If you control one trade, the drugs, you can influence the other, the guns. And the Sena party is desperate to control the flow of guns into their state, their Maharashtra. Money and power. Look there, at the table next to Rafik and his men. You see the three Africans, two men and a woman?"
"Yes, I noticed her before. She's very beautiful." Her young face, with its prominent cheekbones, softly flared nose, and very full lips, looked as if it had been carved in volcanic stone by the rush of a river. Her hair was braided into a multitude of long, fine beaded plaits. She laughed, sharing a joke with her friends, and her teeth gleamed, large and perfectly white.
Beautiful? I think not. Among the Africans, the men are beautiful, in my opinion, whereas the women are merely very attractive. For Europeans, the opposite is true. Carla is beautiful, and I never knew a European man who is beautiful in that way. But that is another matter. I mean only to say that they are customers of Rafik, Nigerians, and that their business between Bombay and Lagos is one of the concessions. A spin-off is the term, I think, of this deal with the Sainiks. The Sena has a man at Bombay Customs. So much money is moving from hand to hand. Rafik's little scheme is a tangle of countries. Afghanistan and India, Pakistan and Nigeria, and of powers, police and customs and politicians. All of it is a part of the struggle for control here in our cursed and beloved Bombay. And all of it, all this intrigue, grows from the closing down of my dear old opium dens. A tragedy.
This Rafik, I muttered, perhaps sounding more flippant than I'd intended, is quite a guy.
He is Afghan, and his country is at war, my friend. That gives him an edge, as the Americans say. And he works for the Walid Lala Mafia Council, one of the most powerful. His closest associate is Chuha, one of the most dangerous men in Bombay. But the real power here, in this part of the city, is the great Don, Lord Abdelkader Khan. He is a poet, a philosopher, and a lord of crime. They call him Kader Bai, Kader Elder Brother. There are others with more money and more guns than Kader Bai. He is a man of rigid principles, you see, and there are many lucrative things that he will not do. But those same principles give him, I'm not sure how to say it in English, the immoral high ground, perhaps. And there is no one in this part of Bombay who has more real power than he does. Many people believe that he is a saint with supernatural capabilities. I know him, and I can tell you that Kader Bai is the most fascinating man I ever met. If you will allow me the small immodesty, this makes him a truly remarkable individual, for I have met a great many interesting men in my life.
He left the words to swirl for a moment in the eye contact between us.
Come, you are not drinking. I hate it when people take so long to drink a single glass. It is like putting on a condom to masturbate.
No, really, I laughed. I'm waiting for Carla to come back. She's due any minute now.
Ah, Carla.
He said her name with a long, purring roll.
And just what are your intentions with our inscrutable Carla?
Come again?
Perhaps it is more useful to wonder what intentions she has for you, no?
He poured the last of the 1 liter bottle into his glass and topped it up with the last of the soda. He'd been drinking steadily for more than an hour. His eyes were as veined and bloodshot as the back of a boxer's fist, but the gaze that stared from them was unwavering, and his hands were precise in their movements.
I saw her on the streets just hours after I landed in Bombay, I found myself saying. There was something about her that... I think she's one of the reasons why I've stayed here this long. Her and Prabhakar. I like them. I liked them both on sight. I'm a people person, if you know what I mean. If the people in it were interesting, I'd prefer a tin shed to the Taj Mahal. Not that I've seen the Taj Mahal yet.
It leaks,
Didier sniffed, dismissing the architectural wonder with two words.
But did you say interesting? Carla is interesting?
He laughed out loud again. It was a peculiarly high-pitched laugh, harsh and almost hysterical. He slapped me hard on the back, spilling a little of his drink.
You know, Lin, I approve of you. Even if a commendation from me is a very fragile endorsement.
He drained his glass, thumped it on the table, and wiped his closely trimmed moustache with the back of his hand. When he saw my puzzled expression, he leaned close until our faces were only a few centimetres apart.
Let me explain something to you. Look around here. How many people do you count?
Well, maybe 60, 80.
80 people. Greeks, Germans, Italians, French, Americans. Tourists from everywhere. Eating, drinking, talking, laughing. And from Bombay. Indians and Iranians and Afghans and Arabs and Africans. But how many of these people have real power, a real destiny, a real dynamique for their place and their time and the lives of thousands of people? I will tell you, four. Four people in this room with power. And the rest are like the rest of the people everywhere. Powerless, sleepers in the dream, anonyme. When Carla comes back, there will be five people in this room with power. That is Carla, the one you call interesting. I see by your expression, my young friend, you do not understand what I am saying. Let me put it this way. Carla is reasonably good at being a friend, but she's stupendously good at being an enemy. When you judge the power that is in a person, you must judge their capacities as both friend and as enemy. And there is no one in this city that makes a worse or more dangerous enemy than Carla.
He stared into my eyes, looking for something, moving from one eye to the other and back again.
You know the kind of power I'm talking about, don't you? Real power. The power to make men shine like the stars, or crush them to dust. The power of secrets. Terrible, terrible secrets. The power to live without remorse or regret. Is there something in your life, Lin, that you regret? Is there anything you have done that you regret it?
Yes, I guess I...
Of course you do. And so do I. Regret things I have done and not done. But not Carla. And that is why she is like the others, the few others in this room who have real power. She has a heart like theirs, and you and I do not. Forgive me. I am almost drunk, and I see that my Italians are leaving. Our joy will not wait for much longer. I must go, now, and collect my little commission, before I can allow myself to be completely drunk.
He sat back in his chair, and then pushed himself to his feet, by leaning heavily on the table with both of his soft, white hands. Without another word or look, he left, and I watched him walk toward the kitchen, threading his way through the tables with the rolling, spongy step of the practiced drinker. His sports coat was creased and wrinkled at the back, where he'd been leaning against the chair, and the seat of his trousers hung in baggy folds. Before I knew him well enough, before I realized how much it meant that he'd lived by crime and passion for 8 years in Bombay without making a single enemy and without borrowing a single dollar, I tended to dismiss Didier as little more than an amusing but hopeless drunkard. It was an easy mistake to make, and one that he himself encouraged. The first rule of black business everywhere is never let anyone know what you're thinking. Didier's corollary to the rule was always know what the other thinks of you. The shabby clothes, the matted curly hair, pressed flat in places where it had rested on the pillow the night before, even his fondness for alcohol, exaggerated into what seemed to be a debilitating addiction. These were all expressions of an image he cultivated and were as carefully nuanced as a professional actor's. He made people think that he was harmless and helpless, because that was the precise opposite of the truth. I had little time to think about Didier and the puzzling remarks he'd made, however, because Carla soon returned, and we left the restaurant almost at once. We took the long way to her small house, walking beside the sea wall that runs from the Gateway of India to the Radio Club Hotel. The long, wide street was empty. On our right, behind a row of plane trees, were hotels and apartment buildings. A few lights, here and there, showed window graphs of the lives being lived in those rooms. A sculpture displayed on one wall, a shelf of books on another, a poster of some Indian deity, framed in wood, surrounded by flowers and smoky streamers of incense. And, just visible in the corner of a street-level window, two slender hands pressed together in prayer. On our left was a vast segment of the world's largest harbour, the dark water starred by the moorage lights of 100 ships at anchor. Beyond them, the horizon quivered with fires flung from the towers of offshore refineries. There was no moon. It was nearly midnight, but the air was still as warm as it had been in the early afternoon. High tide on the Arabian Sea brought occasional sprays over the waist-high stone wall. Mists that swirled on the Simoom all the way from the coast of Africa. We walked slowly. I looked up often at the sky, so heavy with stars that the black net of night was bulging, overflowing with its glittering hall. Imprisonment meant years without a sunrise, a sunset, or a night sky. Locked in a cell for 16 hours each day, from early afternoon to late morning, imprisonment meant that they took away the sun and the moon and the stars. Prison wasn't hell, but there was no heaven in it either. In its own way, that was just as bad.
You can take this good listener business a little too far, you know.
What? Oh, sorry. I was thinking. I apologized and shook myself into the moment. Hey, before I forget, here's that money Ulla gave me. She accepted the roll of notes from me and shoved it into her handbag without looking at it.
It's strange, you know. Ulla went with Modena to break away from someone else who was controlling her like a slave. Now she's Modena's slave, in a way. But she loves him, and that makes her ashamed that she has to lie to him to keep a little money for herself.
Some people need the master-slave thing.
Not just some people,
she responded, with sudden and disconcerting bitterness.
When you were talking to Didier about freedom, when he asked you the freedom to do what, you said the freedom to say no. It's funny, but I was thinking it's far more important to have the freedom to say yes.
Speaking of Didier, I said lightly, trying to change the subject and lift her spirits. I had a long talk with him tonight while I was waiting for you.
I think Didier would have done most of the talking, she guessed.
Well, yes, he did, but it was interesting. I enjoyed it. It's the first time we've ever talked like that.
What did he tell you?
Tell me. The phrase struck me as peculiar. It carried the hint that there were things he shouldn't tell. He was giving me some background on some of the people at Leopold's, the Afghans and the Iranians and the Shiv Sainiks, or whatever they're called, and the local mafia dons. She gave a wry little smile.
I wouldn't take too much notice of what Didier says. He can be very superficial, especially when he's being serious. He's the kind of guy who gets right down to the skin of things, if you know what I mean. I told him once he's so shallow that the best he can manage is a single entendre. The funny thing is, he liked it. I'll say this for Didier. You can't insult him.
I thought you two were friends, I remarked, deciding not to repeat what Didier had said about her.
Friends? Well, sometimes I'm not really sure what friendship is. We've known each other for years. We used to live together once. Did he tell you?
No, he didn't.
Yeah, for a year, when I first came to Bombay, we shared a crazy, fractured little apartment in the fort area. The building was crumbling around us. Every morning we used to wake with plaster on our faces from the pregnant ceiling, and there were always new chunks of stone and wood and other stuff in the hallway. The whole building collapsed in the monsoon a couple of years ago, and a few people were killed. I walk that way sometimes, and look up at the hole in the sky where my bedroom used to be. I suppose you could say that we're close, Didier and I, but friends... Friendship is something that gets harder to understand every damn year of my life. Friendship is like a kind of algebra test that nobody passes. In my worst moods, I think the best you can say is that a friend is anyone you don't despise.
Her tone was serious, but I allowed myself a gentle laugh.
Oh, that's a bit strong, I think.
She looked at me, frowning hard, but then she too laughed.
Maybe it is. I'm tired. I haven't had enough sleep for the last few nights. I don't mean to be hard on Didier. It's just that he can be very annoying sometimes, you know? Did he say anything about me?
He said that he thinks you're beautiful.
He said that?
Yes. He was talking about beauty in white people and black people, and he said, Carla is beautiful. She raised her eyebrows in mild and pleased surprise.
Well, I'll take that as a significant compliment, even if he is an outrageous liar.
I like Didier.
Why?
She asked quickly. Oh, I don't know. It's his professionalism, I think. I like people who are expert at what they do. And there's a sadness in him that kind of makes sense to me. He reminds me of a few guys I know. Friends.
At least he makes no secret of his decadence, she declared.
And I was suddenly reminded of something Didier had told me about Carla and the power of secrets.
Perhaps that's what we really have in common, Didier and I. We both hate hypocrites. Hypocrisy is just another kind of cruelty. And Didier's not cruel. He's wild, but he's not cruel. He's been quiet in the last while. But there were times when his passionate affairs were the scandal of the city, or at least of the foreigners who live here. A jealous lover, a young Moroccan boy, chased him down the causeway with a sword one night. They were both stark naked. Quite a shocking event in Bombay, and in the case of Didier, something of a spectacle, I can report. He ran into the Colaba police station, and they rescued him. They are very conservative about such things in India, but Didier has one rule. He never has any sex involvement with Indians. And I think they respect that. A lot of foreigners come here just for the sex with very young Indian boys. Didier despises them, and he restricts himself to affairs with foreigners. I wouldn't be surprised if that's why he told you so much of other people's business tonight. He was trying to seduce you, perhaps, by impressing you with his knowledge of dark business and dark people.
Oh, hello. Katsili? Hey, where did you come from?
We'd come upon a cat that was squatting on the sea wall to eat from a parcel someone had discarded there. The thin grey animal hunkered down and scowled, growling and whining at the same time. But it allowed Carla to stroke its back as it lowered its head to the food once more. It was a wizened and scabrous specimen, with one ear chewed to the shape of a rosebud, and bare patches on its sides and back, where unhealed sores were exposed. I found it amazing that such a feral, emaciated creature should permit itself to be petted by a stranger, and that Carla would want to do such a thing. Even more astounding, it seemed to me then, was that the cat had such a keen appetite for vegetables and rice, cooked in a sauce of whole, very hot chilies.
Oh, look at him,
she cooed.
Isn't he beautiful?
Well,
don't you admire his courage, his determination to survive?
I'm afraid I don't like cats very much. I don't mind dogs, but cats...
But you must love cats. In a perfect world, all the people would be like cats are at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
I laughed. Did anyone ever tell you you've got a very peculiar way of putting things?
What do you mean?
She asked, turning to me quickly. Even in the streetlight, I could see that her face was flushed, almost angry.
I didn't know then that the English language was a gentle obsession with her, that she studied and wrote and worked hard to compose those clever fragments of her conversation. Just that you have a unique way of expressing yourself. Don't get me wrong. I like it. I like it very much. It's like, well, take yesterday, for instance. When we were all talking about truth, capital T truth, absolute truth, ultimate truth, and is there any truth, is anything true? Everybody had something to say about it. Didier, Ulla, Maurizio, even Medina. Then you said, the truth is a bully we all pretend to like. I was knocked out by it. Did you read that in a book or hear it in a play or a movie?
No, I made it up myself.
Well, that's what I mean. I don't think I could repeat anything that the others said and be sure of getting it exactly right, but that line of yours, I'll never forget it.
Do you agree with it?
What, that the truth is a bully we all pretend to like?
Yes.
No, I don't. Not at all. But I love the idea and the way you put it. Her half-smile held my stare. We were silent for a few moments, and just as she began to look away, I spoke again to hold her attention. Why do you like Biarritz?
What?
The other day, the day before yesterday, you said that Biarritz is one of your favourite places. I've never been there, so I don't know one way or the other, but I'd like to know why you like it so much. She smiled, wrinkling her nose in a quizzical expression that might have been scornful or pleased.
You remember that? Then I guess I better tell you. Biarritz. How to explain it? I think it's the ocean, the Atlantic. I love Biarritz in the wintertime, when the tourists are gone, and the sea is so frightening that it turns people to stone. You see them standing on the deserted beaches and staring at the sea, statues scattered along the beach between the cliffs, frozen stiff by the terror they feel when they look at the ocean. It's not like other oceans, not like the warm Pacific or the Indian. The Atlantic there, in winter, is really unforgiving and ruthlessly cruel. You can feel it calling to you. You know it wants to drag you out and pull you under. It's so beautiful, I just burst into tears the first time I really looked at it. And I wanted to go to it. I wanted to let myself go out and under the big, angry waves. It's the scariest thing. But the people in Biarritz, they're the most tolerant and easygoing people in Europe, I think. Nothing freaks them out. Nothing is too over the top. It's kind of weird. In most holiday places, the people are angry and the sea is calm. In Biarritz, it's the other way around.
Do you think you'll go back there one day? To stay, I mean?
No, she said quickly. If I ever leave here for good, it'll mean going back to the States. I grew up there after my parents died. And I'd like to go back someday. I think I love it there most of all. There's something so confident and open-hearted and brave about America and the American people. I don't feel American. At least I don't think I do. But I'm comfortable with them, if you know what I mean. More than I am with any other people, anywhere.
Tell me about the others, I asked, wanting to keep her talking.
The others? She asked, frowning suddenly.
The crew at Leopold's, Didier and the others. Tell me about Letitia to start with. How do you know her?
She relaxed and let her eyes roam the shadows on the far side of the street. Still thinking, still considering, she lifted her gaze to the night sky. The blue-white light from a street lamp melted to liquid on her lips and in the spheres of her large eyes.
Letty lived in Goa for a while,
she began, affection playing in her voice.
She came to India for the usual mix, parties and spiritual highs. She found the parties, and she enjoyed them, I think. Letty loves a party. But she never had much luck with the spiritual side of things. She went back to London, twice in the same year. But then she came back to India for one last try at the soul thing. She's on a soul mission. She talks tough, but she's a very spiritual girl. I think she's the most spiritual of all of us, really.
How does she live? I don't mean to pry. It's what I was saying before. I just want to learn how people make a living here. How foreigners get by, I mean.
She's an expert with gems, gemstones and jewels. She works on a commission basis for some of the foreign buyers. It was Didier who got her the job. He has contacts everywhere in Bombay.
Didier? I smiled, genuinely surprised. I thought that they hated each other. Well, not hate exactly. I thought they couldn't stand each other.
Oh, they annoy one another, sure. But there's a real friendship there. If anything bad happened to one of them, the other would be devastated.
How about Maurizio? I asked, trying to keep my tone even. The tall Italian was too handsome, too confident, and I envied him for what I saw as his deeper knowledge of Carla and his friendship with her. What's his story?
His story? I don't know what his story is, she replied, frowning again. His parents died, leaving him a lot of money. He spent it. And I think he developed something of a talent for spending money.
Other people's money? I asked. I might have seemed too eager for that to be true, because she answered me with a question.
Do you know the story of the scorpion and the frog? You know, the frog agrees to carry the scorpion across the river, because the scorpion promises not to sting him.
Yeah. And then the scorpion stings the frog halfway across the river. The drowning frog asks him why he did it when they'll both drown. And the scorpion says that he's a scorpion, and it's his nature to sting.
Yes, she sighed, nodding slowly until the frown left her brow. That's Maurizio. And if you know that, he's not a problem, because you just don't offer to carry him across the river. Do you know what I mean?
I'd been in prison. I knew exactly what she meant. I nodded and asked her about Ulla and Modena.
I like Ulla, she answered quickly, turning that half-smile on me again. She's crazy and unreliable, but I have a feeling for her. She was a rich girl in Germany, and she played with heroin until she got a habit. Her family cut her off, so she came to India. She was with a bad guy, a German guy, a junkie like her, who put her to work in a very tough place, a horrible place. She loved the guy. She did it for him. She would have done anything for him. Some women are like that. Some loves are like that. Most loves are like that from what I can see. Your heart starts to feel like an overcrowded lifeboat. You throw your pride out to keep it afloat, and your self-respect and your independence. After a while, you start throwing people out, your friends, everyone you used to know. And it's still not enough. The lifeboat is still sinking, and you know it's going to take you down with it. I've seen that happen to a lot of girls here. I think that's why I'm sick of love.
I couldn't tell if she was talking about herself or pointing the words at me. Either way, they were sharp, and I didn't want to hear them. And how about Kavita? Where does she fit in?
Kavita's great. She's a freelancer, you know that, a freelance writer. She wants to be a journalist, and I think she'll get there. I hope she gets there. She's bright and honest and gutsy. She's beautiful, too. Don't you think she's a gorgeous girl?
Sure, I agreed, recalling the honey-colored eyes, the full and shapely lips, and the long, expressive fingers. She's a pretty girl, but they're all good-looking people, I think. Even Didier, in his crumpled-up way, has got a touch of the Lord Byron about him. Letty's a lovely girl. Her eyes are always laughing. They're real ice blue, her eyes, aren't they? Ulla looks like a doll, with those big eyes and big lips on such a round face. But it's a pretty doll's face. Maurizio's handsome, like a magazine model. And Medina's handsome in a different way, like a bullfighter or something. And you're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen with my own eyes. There, I'd said it. And even in the shock of speaking the thought out loud, I wondered if she'd understood, if she'd pierced my words about their beauty and hers, to find the misery that inspired them, the misery that an ugly man feels in every conscious minute of love. She laughed, a good, deep, wide-mouthed laugh, and seized my arm impulsively, pulling me along the footpath. Just then, as if drawn from the shadows by her laughter, there was a clattering rattle of noise as a beggar, riding on a small wooden platform with metal ball-bearing wheels, rolled off the footpath on the opposite side of the street. He pushed himself forward with his hands until he reached the centre of the deserted road, wheeling to a stop with a dramatic pirouette. His piteously thin mantis legs were folded and tucked beneath him on the platform, which was a piece of wood no bigger than a folded newspaper. He wore a boy's school uniform of khaki shorts and a powder blue shirt. Although he was a man in his 20s, the clothes were too big for him. Carla called out, greeting him by name, and we stopped opposite him. They spoke for some time in Hindi. I stared across the 10 meters that separated us, fascinated by the man's hands. They were huge hands, as wide across the back, from knuckle to knuckle, as his face. In the streetlight, I could see that they were thickly padded on the fingers and palms, like the paws of a bear. "Good night," he called out in English after a minute. He lifted one hand, first to his forehead and then to his heart, in a delicate gesture of consummate gallantry. With another swift, show-off's pirouette, he propelled himself forward along the road, gaining speed as he rolled down the gentle slope to the Gateway Monument. We watched him out of sight, and then Carla pulled at my arm, leading me along the path once more. I allowed myself to be led. I allowed myself to be drawn by the soft pleading of the waves and the roulade of her voice, by the black sky and the darker night of her hair, by the sea-tree-stone smell of the sleeping street and the perfume sublime on her warm skin. I allowed myself to be drawn into her life and the life of the city. I walked her home. I said goodnight. And I was singing quietly to myself as I went back along the silent brood of streets to my hotel. Chapter 3. What you're saying is that we're finally going to get down to the real deal.
"Real will be full, Baba," Prabhakar assured me. "And deal will be plenty also. Now you will see it, the really city. Usually I am never taking the tourists to these places. They are not liking it, and I am not liking they are not liking. Or maybe sometimes they are liking it too much in these places, and I am liking that even less, isn't it? You must have it a good heads to like these things, and you must be having a good hearts to not like them too much. Like you, Lin Baba. You are my good friend. I knew it very well on that first day when we were drinking the whiskey in your room. Now, my Bombay, with your good heads and your good hearts, you will see it all."
We were riding in a taxi along Mahatma Gandhi Road, past Flora Fountain and towards Victoria Station. It was an hour before noon, and the swash of traffic that coursed through that stone canyon was swollen by large numbers of runners pushing tiffin carts. The runners collected lunches from homes and apartments and placed them in tin cylinders called jalpans, or tiffins. They pushed huge trays of the tiffins on long wooden carts, 6 men and more to a cart. Through the heavy metal traffic of buses, trucks, scooters and cars, they made deliveries at offices and businesses all over the city. None but the men and women who operated the service knew exactly how it was done. How barely literate men evolved the bafflingly complex system of symbols, colours, and key numbers to mark and identify the cylinders. How, day after day, hundreds of thousands of those identical containers swept through the city on their wooden axles, oiled with sweat, and reached the right man or woman
among millions every time, and how all that was achieved at a cost measured in cents rather than dollars. Magic, the trick that connects the ordinary to the impossible, was the invisible river that ran through every street and beating heart in Bombay in those years. And nothing, from the postal service to the pleading of beggars, worked without a measure of it.
What number that bus, Lin Baba? Quickly tell it.
Just a second. I hesitated, peering out of the half-open window of the taxi and trying to read the curlicue numbers on the front of a red double-decker bus that had stopped opposite us momentarily.
It's a 104, isn't it? Very, very fine. You have learned your Hindi numbers so nicely. Now, no problem for you. Reading numbers for bus and train and menu card and drugs purchase and other good things. Now, tell me, what is aloo palak?
Aloo palak is potato and spinach.
Good. And nice eating also, you have not mentioned. I love to eat it, aloo palak. What is full gobi and bindi?
That's cauliflower and okra.
Correct. And also good eating, again you are not mentioned. What is baigan masala?
That's spiced eggplant.
Again, right. What is it? You're not enjoying eating baigan?
Yes, all right. Baigan is good eating too.
I don't like it baigan so much,
he sneered, wrinkling up his short nose.
Tell me, what am I calling chera, mon, and dil?
Okay, don't tell me. Face, mouth, and heart. Is that right?
Very right, no problem. I've been watching it how nicely you eat up your foods with the hand, like a good Indian style. And now you learn to ask for the things. How much this, how much that? Give me 2 cups of tea, I want more hashish. Speaking only Hindi to the people. I have seen this all. You are my best student, Lin Baba. And I am your best teacher also, isn't it?
It is, Prabhu, I laughed.
Hey, watch out!
My shout alerted the taxi driver, who swerved just in time to avoid an ox cart that was attempting to make a turn in front of us. The taxi driver, a burly, dark-skinned man with a bristling moustache, seemed to be outraged at my impertinence in saving our lives. When we first took the taxi, he'd adjusted his mirror until he saw nothing in it but my face. After the near miss, he glared at me, snarling a growl of insults in Hindi. He drove the cab like a getaway car, slewing left and right to overtake slower vehicles. There was an angry, bullying pugnacity in his attitude to everyone else on the road. He rushed to within centimetres of every slower car in his path, sounding his horn, then all but nudging it out of the way. If the slower car moved a little to the left in order to let him pass, our driver drew beside it, pacing it for a time and shouting insults. When he spied another slow vehicle ahead, he sped forward to repeat the procedure. From time to time, he opened his door and leaned out over the road to spit pan juice, taking his eyes off the traffic ahead for long seconds as we hurtled along in the rattling cab.
This guy's a nutcase, I muttered to Prabhakar.
Driving is not so good,
Prabhakar replied, bracing himself with both arms against the back of the driver's seat.
But I have to say, the spitting and insulting is a first-class job.
For Christ's sake, tell him to stop, I shouted, as the cab accelerated into a squall of traffic, lurching in the swerve left and right.
He's going to kill us!
Bant karo!
Prabhakar shouted.
Stop!
He added a pithy curse for good measure, but the driver only became more enraged. With the car hurtling along at top speed, he turned his head to snarl at us. His mouth was wide open and his teeth were bared. His eyes were huge, their blackness streaked with rage.
Arey!
Prabhakar shrieked, pointing past the driver. It was too late. The man turned quickly. His arms stiffened at the wheel and he hit the brakes hard. There was a skating, sliding second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds. I heard a guttural gasp of air from deep in his throat. It was a sucking sound, like the lifting of a flat stone from the moist clay on the edge of a riverbed. Then there was the whump and crash as we slammed into a car that had stopped in front of us to make a turn. We were thrown forward into the back of his seat and heard 2 thumping explosions as 2 other cars rammed into us. Shattered glass and chrome fragments rattled on the road like thin metallic applause in the sudden silence that followed the impacts. My head had hit the door in the tumble spill of the accident.
I felt blood flowing from a cut above my eye, but I was otherwise unhurt. As I wriggled myself up from the floor,